Hey, everybody. Since this episode deals with addiction, I thought I would open with a shout out to addiction treatment program, EVO, located in Venice, California. Some of you know that I've been working closely with EVO in a research and clinical capacity. They have a very progressive approach to working with people dealing with problematic substance use and are aligned with postmodern therapy and just practices. I encourage you to check them out at evohealthandwellness.com or evohw.com. and tell them Chris Hoff sent you. Now let's get to the show.
This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 34. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm very excited about this episode. We are going to be exploring addiction, addiction treatment, prevention, drug policy with author Maya Solovitz, who wrote the book Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. A book I think you all should pick up immediately and start reading, especially if you are working in the realm of, you know, substance use, substance misuse. You'll find it very, very helpful. But before we get to Maya, I just have a couple of quick announcements like I always do. And the first one is that I don't know if you know this yet, but the Radical Therapist now has a YouTube channel, and we would really appreciate if you went to YouTube and searched us out and subscribed to our channel, as well as maybe watch a few of the videos, share a few of the videos, that kind of thing. We just had a new one up on attachment theory. Is attachment theory overrated? And I think you'll find that kind of very interesting video. And I got some new ones coming. New content is coming. So please go check out the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. Spread the word. And also, I still have stickers, Radical Therapist stickers. If you want a sticker, I'll send them out to you for free. Just shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com, and I will send you stickers. I also have t-shirts, Radical Therapist t-shirts. If you want to know what they look like, go over to the Radical Therapist Instagram site, which is at just search Radical Therapist at Instagram. And there's several photos of people sporting the Radical Therapist t-shirt. I got a new batch in. If you want a t-shirt, shoot me an email or send me a message or what have you. And I'll send them out until I run out. So first come, first serve. Let me know if you'd like a t-shirt. And if, you know, the only cost of the t-shirt is just tell somebody about the podcast or the YouTube channel. Share it. Share them around. It'd be much appreciated. So. And so that's it for now. So why don't we get right to the interview? And before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about Maya. Maya Solovitz is one of the premier American journalists covering addiction and drugs. Her book, Help at Any Cost, was the first book-length expose of the tough love business that dominates addiction treatment, particularly for teens. She's a co-author of Born for Love and The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, both with Dr. Bruce D. Perry, and her work often appears in publications such as Time.com, The New York Times, Scientific American, Ellie, Vice, and New York Magazine. She is a 2015-2016 Soros Justice Fellow and has received major awards for her coverage of neuroscience and addiction from the American Psychological Association, the Drug Policy Alliance, and the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology. So without further ado, let's meet Maya. Okay, welcome to the show, Maya.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, I appreciate you taking the time. I really appreciated your book that we're going to kind of be talking about today. I think it's a book that, you know, my audience obviously is a lot of therapists, psychologists, social workers, and I think they all should be reading this book. Yeah, very important, and I really appreciate you taking the time. So I thought to get started, I guess my first question, and the title of the book, just for everybody, is The Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. And in your book, you kind of start by saying that sadly, had you nodded off in the 80s and somehow was revived now, you wouldn't find much different about how we face and deal with addiction. And I guess I know this is kind of a big question, but what are your thoughts about the state of addiction views and treatment currently?
Sure. I mean, it's this weirdly paradoxical time where, I mean, the current administration aside, there has actually recently been some real movement towards improving things. Huh. But we're still in a situation where criminalization is the primary way we deal with addiction, where 80 to 90% of behavioral treatment is still focused on getting people to accept 12-step ideology.
Right.
Medication-assisted treatment, which I hate the term, I'm just going to call it medication treatment. Medication treatment, the only thing that we know that cuts the death rate 50% or more for opioid addiction is long-term, potentially lifelong use of methadone or buprenorphine. And yet such treatment is rarely available and heavily stigmatized, despite some valiant efforts to improve access. So, yeah, if I got out, if I needed treatment today, I'd still be facing the same environment of these 28-day 12-step rehabs, some of which have sort of renamed what they do to be cognitive behavioral or motivational enhancement, but they're still strongly, from the patient's perspective, focused on getting you to go to meetings and accept that ideology. I'd still see that. I would still see the stigma against medication. And I would also be still faced with a situation where, putting people in jail is still seen as a good idea as a way to deal with drug problems.
Right. And in your book, I'm just going to maybe jump to this place. You write about, that we need to confront the role of race in our concepts of addiction, and it's critical in developing better definitions of the problem, treatment, and policies. Could you say more about that, about the role of race?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, well, what's terrible is that if you think about the stereotype of a person with addiction, it's virtually identical to the stereotypes we have of minorities. So you've got like lazy, criminal, devious, manipulative, dishonest, and there's a reason for the overlap between those stereotypes, and it's because politicians have used racist imagery of addiction and laws about drugs to oppress people of color, particularly Black people. And this has been, really well shown in Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. It is demonstrated all the time whenever any middle-class white person says, "I'm not your typical addict."
Right.
That, and I have to say, I used to say that. But that I have realized is basically a racist statement, because the implication is that the typical addict is a poor Black person. And that is actually not true. And we have created that image in order to oppress Black people, basically. And it sounds like extreme when stated that nakedly. But the reality is that if you look at the history of our drug laws, all of them were made for explicitly racist or anti-immigrant reasons. And this includes alcohol prohibition. So you've got like the first anti-opium laws are laws about related to Chinese railroad workers. And the idea is that these Chinese railroad workers are going to use this horrible substance to like seduce white women. So, that's how we get the first anti-opium laws. And with cocaine, you get this idea that like, oh no, this drug is going to make Black men impervious to bullets, and it's going to make them super strong, and it's going to make them seduce white women. And so we got to make this stuff illegal. When you get to marijuana, you get the same exact thing about the white women and the idea that this drug is going to make you into a crazy maniac or, God forbid, a jazz musician. And, and it's used by Mexicans. And, it's just like, it's all this crazy racist stuff. And when you look, I think a lot of people figure that the basis for our drug laws was some kind of, you know, commission that sat down and said, okay, like alcohol and tobacco, these are not so bad. These other ones are really bad. So we'll put alcohol and tobacco legal. And this could not be done because a rational person could not make the choices that were made. The choices that were made about what drugs are legal and illegal were basically what drugs do white people think should be legal or illegal. And when, you know, there was a fear about immigration and certain groups, Germans and Irish, with regard to alcohol, suddenly we have prohibition. So it's really, once you know the history, it's really hard to see our laws as anything but irrational, contingent, racist nonsense. And once you get to that place, you have to figure out, well, okay, so what do we do now? How do we help people with addiction if we are really going to deal with the genuine, real problems that do occur when some people get in trouble with drugs? How are we going to deal with this in light of what we've done socially to isolate and demean and dehumanize people in relation to this issue?
Right. And we'll get there. And you do, and just for the listeners, you do a really nice job of laying out that history in the book. But I want to talk about, you begin to describe, and I really appreciate this view that you kind of bring forward in your book. This, you describe addiction as coping behaviors that often get misinterpreted as the source of the problem rather than being seen as attempts at solutions. And I think that was really great. And can you say more about that?
Sure. So, I mean, this kind of really occurred to me when I began thinking about parallels between addiction and autism. And that sounds weird, but I actually, it turns out, would have probably been diagnosed on the autism spectrum as a child if the Asperger's diagnosis had existed at the time, because I had all kinds of behaviors that were very, very ASPY. I was just, you know, socially isolated and had repetitive behaviors and all kinds of things like this. And with both addiction and autism, the stuff that people do to cope looks really weird and looks kind of scary to people who are not using such behavior to cope. So if you're like sticking a needle in your arm, that looks really scary. And, you know, it seems like, you know, it must be some kind of sick thing, you know? And it seems like you might be some kind of crazy hedonist who only cares about your own pleasure. In reality, you're trying to cope with a world that is overwhelming for you, usually. And you are just sort of trying to be okay. So yeah, and you know, in the case of autism, people just figure, okay, if we get these kids to stop looking weird, we'll solve the problem. Actually, no. The reason they're doing those weird things is to be able to cope with usually sensory overload or sometimes sensory underload. So, okay, so like, but we mistake the coping behavior for the problem. And basically, if you say, okay, why is this person doing this behavior? What problem are they trying to solve with it? And how can we solve that problem in a way that is less harmful? Now, if you're doing some kind of autistic repetitive behavior that is, you know, not harmful to anybody else, it just annoys other people, perhaps the solution is to get the other people to not be annoyed and to realize what's going on. With drugs, similarly, why don't we figure out what people are trying to solve with it and then give them ways of coping that are healthier for them? And, you know, I mean, it's just, we really, you know, demonize people for things we don't understand. And when we begin to understand them, then we can actually make solutions that actually work instead of causing harm.
Right. Okay, and before we get to solutions, I want to lay out, because you put forward in your book this idea that you argue that addiction is a learning disorder with three critical elements: one, that behavior has a psychological purpose; two, that learning pathways involved make it become automatic and compulsive; and three, it doesn't stop when it is no longer adaptive. Can you say more about your conceptualization of addiction?
Sure. So there are some very basic reasons that learning is fundamental to addiction. One of the really obvious ones is that if you don't learn that a drug does something for you, you have no idea what to crave, so you cannot go out and seek it despite negative consequences. This, by the way, is why babies cannot be addicted, because they don't know what they need. Mm. Once you learn that this drug does something for you that is useful to you, then it sort of gets wrapped up in circuitry in the brain that is there for survival and reproduction. So what that means is that basically you fall in love with a drug and your behavior changes, your priorities change in the same way that someone's priorities change when they have a kid or when they fall in love. So you put that child or that lover in front of everything else. You're willing to change your whole life. You're willing to like sacrifice everything. You're willing to go through any kind of obstacle in order to, you know, either take care of your child or be with your partner. So when that system gets misdirected towards a drug, the behavior looks really strange and we don't understand it and we see it as some kind of evil alien thing. Instead of recognizing that, you know, this is just a misdirected use of a system that is there for very good reason. If we couldn't persist despite negative consequences, nobody would be able to successfully have a kid. Like, you would not be able to deal with the diapers and the sleeplessness and all that other stuff that comes with having a baby if you couldn't persist despite negative consequences. So, you know, nature creates these systems for a reason. And we are all human. We all have them. And sometimes they get misdirected. And one of the reasons I called the book Unbroken Brain is that when you fall in love with something, your brain isn't broken. If it's something that is harmful to you, you may have a lot of work to do in order to change that situation. But it doesn't mean that you're brain damaged or that your intelligence is harmed or that anything else is especially harmed by the fact that you have an addiction. Now, this doesn't mean you're not going to have craving. It doesn't mean you might not relapse. There's all kinds of things that we see with people who are in love with the wrong person. And then we see the same thing in addiction. So, well, I think that's a much more hopeful way of viewing it. And, you know, pretty much everybody has been through a breakup that was awful, and pretty much everybody has survived a breakup that was awful. So this also allows you to sort of understand, you know, what's going on and what needs to change when people are recovering from addictions. And this is not to say, of course, that if certain drugs, if you use them to excess, may be bad for your brain, that, you know, alcohol in particular, but the damage that is done by that is neither necessary nor sufficient to cause addiction. And so while that may be sort of collateral damage, what's fundamentally going on in addiction is something different.
Got it. And so how would this conceptualization, or how do you imagine it would, or what are the implications for treatment, prevention, and policy if we hold this conceptualization?
Sure. Well, so the first thing is that addiction is fundamentally defined as compulsive behavior that continues despite negative consequences. Negative consequences is a fancy way of saying punishment.
Right.
Therefore, trying to use punishment to solve a condition that is defined by its resistance to it is rather dumb. What we need to do instead is to understand what's going on and teach people better ways of coping. And not try to force people to hit bottom and force people to submit and do all kinds of humiliating and traumatizing things in order to try to get negative consequences to solve something that negative consequences actually cannot solve. That is like the major implication, which is like stop criminalizing people, stop shaming people, stop humiliating people. Treat people with dignity and respect and recognize that the problem is not that this person has not been punished or has not suffered enough. That is just not the problem in addiction. In fact, when you listen to the stories of people with addiction, the suffering that you hear preceding the addiction is often unbearable. And once you realize this, that, you know, people with addiction tend to have horrible histories of trauma and or mental illness. And, you know, mental illness is in 50%, trauma is in 2/3. You know, there's lots of stuff going on with people with addiction. And when we realize that they are just trying to feel okay, not trying to get extra, we can deal with it a little better. So that's one. The second thing is that since addiction is basically a problem with learning from punishment, we need to use other ways of teaching in order to help people recover. Now, actually, there's lots of research suggesting that using rewards can be quite effective, but we don't like to do that because we think that would be punishing people. You know, that would be rewarding people for doing the wrong thing or whatever.
Right.
But anyways, that's one implication. But another one is just that, you know, when you think about the most difficult thing people ever have to learn, it's language. Like, as a baby, you go from, like, not knowing language to being able to speak fluently, and virtually everybody does it. And this does not happen via parents, like, hitting the kid for, like, not speaking correctly. It happens because, A, speaking is a lot more pleasant than crying, and B, you get what you want a lot more easily with, you know, speech than with crying, because you can be a lot more specific. Plus, it's much more pleasant in general. So, anyway, we need to learn through pleasure and through, you know, sort of connection. And, you know, the way kids learn language is in relationship to others. And similarly, that's the way we learn recovery. And, you know, this is one thing that 12-step programs get right. It is correct that connection and support and, you know, being part of something is really important to recovery. It's just that that thing, whatever it's going to be, is probably going to be different for different people. For some people, it might be a 12-step program. For other people, it might be a church. For other people, it might be politics. For other people, it might be music. It's going to be really varied. And that's another key lesson. Because addiction is a problem with learning, and learning is highly individualized, and what you learn and what you experience is very different from person to person, you need to figure out, okay, what's gone wrong here? What have you learned? What are you trying to cope with? And then provide the individualized solutions that help that person deal with those particular issues. Because, you know, putting a CEO who has a cocaine problem in a job training program is not going to be very effective.
Right. And then how about policy? How do we change, or how do you said things were starting to look better, or you thought they were?
Well, I mean, you know, like, one of the things that I think has been incredibly positive has been the marijuana legalization movement. Right. And the reason I see that is because once you realize that our marijuana laws were based on complete racist nonsense and that changing them does not cause the sky to collapse, you can start to rethink all kinds of other aspects of policy. And particularly, you can recognize that putting people in cages for selling or using marijuana doesn't do anybody any good, except, I guess, prison guards. You know, the justice complex. But, sure. You know, it doesn't help fight addiction. It doesn't stop kids from smoking pot. It causes all kinds of harm. So once you realize that putting people in cages isn't helpful for preventing marijuana use, you should begin to realize that putting people in cages is not going to be especially effective for, you know, cocaine or heroin or anything else. Now, there's a much more difficult and nuanced discussion to be had about legalizing sales of other things. But I don't think anybody, and I had an argument on Twitter last night regarding this, but
I saw it.
Nobody has ever been able to come up with a good argument for criminalization. Like, the former arguments were, well, right, it stigmatizes drug use, so it will prevent, you know, people from starting. Well, we had 70% of our population smoking pot at one point, you know, at least having tried it in the 80s, the peak of drug use in America. You know, this law is not acting as a deterrent here. At one point, 50% of all people in their 20s, this is when I was in my 20s in the early 80s, 50% had tried cocaine. That's astonishing, you know? And so again, these laws do not, you know, you cannot deter fashion for something that is, you know, the only person it's going to hurt is you. You can't deter that by laws. Once people do not think these laws are valid, you know, it's not going to work.
Right.
What our laws do, unfortunately, is they stigmatize the people who get caught. And they make it harder for people to get jobs. They allow us to lock up lots of black people. They do, you know, tremendous harm in all of those ways that we've heard about a million times. So, you know, anyway, I have not seen anybody come up with a good argument for criminalization. You know, people are like, well, we could use it as a lever to get them into treatment. Well, for one, why are you doing that when we have waiting lists for treatment and we're going to put these people in who don't want it in front of the people who do? And therefore, we'll also make treatment itself worse, because when people are sitting there like this and you're trying to discuss your trauma, it's not going to be a very conducive group to recovery, let's be honest.
Right.
So, it, you know, forcing people in via jail is just a silly thing. Also, if we actually tried to use possession arrests to get people into treatment, we would instantly be overwhelmed. The number of possession arrests that we have, you know, like the drug courts and stuff like that, those aren't people arrested for possession. Those are people arrested for real crimes. And, you know, with the exception of dealing, which we can bracket for now. But the, you know, again, so it's just like we recognize, you know, so the marijuana thing has really allowed people to see that criminalization is really a dumb idea. And even some of the most, you know, strong prohibitionists who used to think they had good arguments for criminalization cannot come up with them now when you press them to do so, as you saw on Twitter last night. So I think that the marijuana thing has been great. The other ridiculous but potentially useful thing is the fact that this opioid epidemic is widely seen as white. And once we see it as being white, although I have to say, hello, I was a white heroin addict in my 20s, which was in the 80s. And by the end of the 60s, 50% of all people with heroin addiction were already white. So it's been white for a long time. But okay, so now we see it as white. Now we're going to be nice to people. Now we're going to see it as a disease. Now we're going to recognize it's a medical problem. Now we're going to decriminalize. Okay, good. All those things should have been done when we saw it as black. But if we're going to do it now, let's do it. This is good, even if it's a ridiculous reason.
Got it.
So, you know, I think that that has led to real progress in seeing people with addiction compassionately. And I also have to say that it isn't just race that has caused this change. I think race has obviously played a huge role. But what has been also important is the fact that we watched this approach fail. We saw this hype throughout the 80s and 90s. And we saw all these, you know, lengthy mandatory minimums and all this kind of stuff. And guess what? Drugs didn't go away.
Nope.
So we watched this fail. We also have in this opioid epidemic, we have the presence, the widespread presence, thank goodness, of naloxone, which is the overdose reversal drug. And what happens when you put that drug in the hands of people who use drugs and their families is that they can save a life right there in front of them. And when parents who've lost a kid to overdose realize that this drug exists and doesn't hurt anybody and could have been available and wasn't, those parents get radicalized. And this happens in a way that did not happen during needle exchange, because needle exchange, you know, 10 years from getting a clean needle, you don't have AIDS. Yay, that's great, but it's not visible. Like, here, I just gave you a shot and you come back to life.
Right.
So this has introduced a lot of parents to harm reduction who in the past might have been really freaked out by it. And that, in the context of the racial stuff and the context of the failure of the drug war, has really pushed us forward towards better policies. And I just hope that we don't suddenly take a giant step backwards. But I actually think that it would be very difficult to unravel the marijuana thing at this point. And it will also be difficult to get the white middle class parents who have become active around this to go back to saying, oh, yeah, let's put our kids in jail. That would be a good thing to help them.
Right, right. Okay, before I get to harm reduction and your thoughts about that and what's happening in that world, I have a question. You say something in the book which I think is really important, and I think it's could be the best thing for treatment and also the best thing for like 12-step programs like AA. You describe how these things need to be kind of uncoupled, right?
Yeah,
in a way that I think AA could go back to being what it does well, like good folk wisdom that helps certain people.
Yeah.
And then treatment could actually get serious about, you know, some other ways of working with clients that are struggling, right? Could you say more about how you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and like, I constantly get misinterpreted as being anti-12-step, and I am not anti-12-step.
Right.
I am anti-forced 12-step, and I am anti-12-step being sold as treatment.
Right, right.
Both of those things violate AA's and the 12-step's own principles.
Agreed.
And but they are still widely done. And, you know, in 12-step programs, the whole idea is this is about attraction, not promotion. This is about what I choose to do. It's for people who want it, not people who need it. All of these things are saying this should be done voluntarily. And this is a group of people who have experience with their own experience and with the community's experience of interpreting that experience. And that's a really useful thing, but that is not medicine. And I like to compare it to, like, you know, if you had treatment for like cancer or something, right? Like, you might only be able to get through chemo because you have the church group there that's like holding you through that and giving you faith and all that kind of stuff. But they're not prescribing your chemo. And they're not saying what dose it should be. And they're not saying, don't ever do radiation, that's evil, you know. They recognize that our role is as spiritual counselors, not as medicine. And they don't make ridiculous arguments that, like, you know, addiction's a disease, but the treatment is prayer, confession, and meeting.
Right.
So, you know, and I think that, you know, clearly many people are massively helped by the social support and camaraderie and all that stuff that you get from 12-step programs. And many people are even helped by the moral aspects of 12-step programs, where you take a moral inventory and you figure out, you know, these kinds of things. But many people are also harmed by that element. And I feel if you voluntarily take what you like and leave the rest, that can be really helpful. But if you're forced into some kind of identity of I'm an addict, or, you know, all this, like, I have character defects that make me a bad person, like, you know, that can be harmful. So I think the best way to solve this problem is to let 12-step support groups be what they were intended to be, which is voluntary self-help. Let the 12th step, where you reach out to others and try to get them involved, let that be the way that you spread 12-step, not you must do this, otherwise you will be not allowed to leave this treatment center.
Right, right.
You know, or you will, you know, be failing drug court or whatever.
Right.
You know, I think that's an abomination. And I think that, you know, Bill Wilson would not be supporting that kind of thing.
No,
You know, coercion is just, I mean, I've looked at this, and actually, if you want to create a cult, a good recipe is coerce the 12 steps on people and make yourself their higher power. Then you can be a fabulous cult leader, because you have created all the elements that Robert J. Lifton identified as being useful for coercive persuasion. So, again, this creates dangerous, abusive treatment programs, and it does not do what the 12 steps were intended to do. So I think, yes, this should be a nice, amicable divorce, and we can refer to 12-step, and we can say why social support is critical, but we should not be having this as an element of therapy. And, you know, some people will argue, oh, but what about 12-step facilitation? That's like evidence-based. The problem is 12-step facilitation is indoctrination into 12-step ideology. And it is no better than cognitive behavioral therapy or motivational enhancement therapy. And given that neither of those other two have the problems inherent with teaching people they must have a higher power, I say we go with the other two as part of professional treatment. Also, I say that as a taxpayer and a person who has insurance, because why should I pay for what you can get for free elsewhere?
Right, right. That's great. And yeah, you lay it out nicely in the book. And okay, so let's talk about harm reduction. I know there's a lot of opinions about that. You cover it really well in the book. Can you say a little bit about the state of harm reduction currently and how you're thinking about it now?
Sure. So the idea of harm reduction is basically that we don't care about drug use. What we care about is drug-related harm. So if you're using drugs and you're not hurting your health or anybody else's, we don't care. What we do care about is if you're at risk for overdose, if you are, not able to be productive, not able to be there for your family, all of these kinds of things. So harm reduction aims at reducing drug-related harms, not drug use. And so the classic example would be needle exchange, where people are given clean needles, that reduces the spread of HIV, and harm is therefore reduced. And so this is important because the vast majority of drug use does not do any harm. First of all, the vast majority of drug use is marijuana use. It is occasional, which is unlikely to do any harm anyway.
Right.
But, you know, the point is that we're not going to take a moral stand against the use of recreational some recreational substances as a appropriate, you know, reason for legislation. What is it is appropriate for the state to intervene when harm is involved. But if no harm is involved, why should the government have any say over what I put in my body? So that's basically the essence of harm reduction. And there are many examples of it. Seatbelts are an example of harm reduction. Mm. Driving is a dangerous thing. Seatbelts reduce the harm. Does that mean people drive more? Probably yes. But there you are. That's the way human beings are. There is other classic examples of harm reduction include naloxone distribution, which is the overdose antidote. And by giving this out, you allow people to have their lives saved when they overdose. And it's remarkably effective. As long as you give it in time, it usually just, you know, brings the person right back. So, you know, we had a saying in the early days of harm reduction, you know, dead addicts don't recover. And, you know, this is the fundamental thing here. It's where there's life, there's hope. If there is, you know, people who are just left to die, it's just, not to mention inhumane, but horrible and a waste. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really important to understand about addiction is that people with addiction are as valuable as any other people. And we have an enormous amount to give. And seeing us as just, you know, some group we can throw away and just let them die and blah, 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 blah. You know, you're losing, you know, artists and, you know, moms and dads and like sisters and cousins and, you know, people who are scientists and lawyers and doctors and all kinds of useful, productive people. and, you know, it's just ridiculous how dehumanizing we are about people with addiction and just how little we value people just because we think they've taken this substance that we consider evil.
Right. You also have a chapter, thank you for that. You also have a chapter on teaching recovery, which I think is really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about teaching recovery?
Sure. So people, you know, when you're addicted, you often become less and less aware of the choices you have available to you. And I think in the book, I use the analogy of like, if you're in a prison cell and there's like a trap door that would allow you to escape, but it's like under a carpet and you don't see it, you're just as well locked in as you would be if it isn't there, if you don't know about it. But once you know, then you can change. And that's what happens in you know, when people recover, you realize, oh, okay, I do have the option of living comfortably in my skin without this substance. Now, there might be a nasty transition period, but I am assured by other people in recovery and by experts and people who know this stuff that once you get through that difficult transition, you will be able to be okay. And you teach recovery by giving people the hope that there will be ways for them to cope that will make life not only bearable, but way better than it was before. And so one of the things that, you know, you teach are the obvious things like, you know, tricks for avoiding relapse, and also sort of how to understand your own thinking and where it might go wrong. This is your sort of basic cognitive behavioral therapy, where it's kind of like, you know, oh, I walk into a room, I think everybody hates me. Oh, I'm thinking that. They might not actually be hating me. This might be my perception. Okay, so let me just look for evidence, right? So when you learn these like cognitive techniques that allow you to feel more comfortable in the world, the more comfortable you feel in the world, the less you need anesthesia, and the, you know, less craving and, you know, desire you have for the substances. But you really need to learn, what are you using these things for, and how can you get, you know, comfort and pleasure and socializing and all the good stuff in life without the substances.
That's great. Okay. I have another question. You present a lot of ideas that are kind of go counter to the monolith. I'm going to call it the monolith of addiction treatment right now, right? You said, which is, you said 80 to 90% are still doing the same thing. What's the pushback been like for you? Or
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting because I actually expected it to be a lot worse. And I have been very happily surprised that a lot of people have just really welcomed these ideas. And a lot of people have just said, oh, like, I now understand my addicted family member, or, oh, I can now have more compassion for myself, like, which isn't what I intended while writing the book, because I was thinking of it more as being about ideas than about sort of helping people, but I'm very glad that it has done. So, you know, but the pushback that I've gotten basically has been from people who are convinced that if you don't force people to do the 12 steps, some disaster will happen. And that, you know, a lot of these people were pushed into 12 steps themselves, and they believe that they, you know, never would have gotten there if that hadn't happened. Yeah. And, you know, no matter how many times I say that I am just saying it should be separate from treatment, they think I'm out there, you know, wanting to, you know, go and like stamp out every AA meeting in the country, which I absolutely do not want to do.
Right.
But so that is really the worst I've gotten. And it's been interesting because the people in the field, I think, are much more open to change than they have been in the past. And I think, you know, a lot of this has to do with the current opioid situation. You know, I mean, one of the things that I wrote an article for Time about this, when Hazelden decided that they were going to start using medication, that was a massive change for an organization that was truly committed to abstinence only 12 step.
Right.
And, you know, to their credit, they saw people dying. They realized that like 12 step alone was not helping, and that in fact, like cleaning somebody out for 28 days and then having them go back was actually increasing their risk. So, you know, so they have begun integrating medication. And so I think, you know, when people sort of start to become open to the ideas of harm reduction, you can see an enormous amount of change. And it's really interesting because, you know, when I was in early recovery myself and harm reduction was just starting and we were just, you know, trying to get needle exchange done so that we wouldn't all die of AIDS, you know, a lot of people in recovery who were involved with 12-step themselves, like, went through that transition, you know, and so it's really interesting to see that a lot more people are open to thinking this way, and that a lot more people are, you know, able to see that, well, what worked for me might not be what works for you. And it's a lot less rigid, I think. And so that has been good. But yeah, like I was sort of expecting to get, but whatever happened, it was the only critiques I've gotten were from the 12-step people. It has not been, I mean, when I first started writing about this stuff, it was kind of funny because I wrote about, you know, addiction and learning disorder, blah, blah, blah. And like some neuroscientists were like, why are you saying that? That's old news. That's not new. I'm like, you guys have not communicated this to the public.
Right.
People, like, I thought that was old news too, until I realized that the public thinks addiction's a disease like cancer. And that metaphor does not actually work very well because, you know, learning is involved in addiction, and learning explains why choice becomes impaired but not eliminated. And so I was just really trying to, like, get people to sort of a middle ground between the extreme moral view, you know, that people are just choosing to be willfully obnoxious, and the extreme disease view that, like, people are just hijacked brain zombies that have no free will. Mm-hmm. And obviously both of those extremes are wrong.
Okay, so you end the book by laying out some new implications for the future of addiction. And I guess could you, just in ending, could you summarize what you feel is important moving forward now?
Sure. So I think really recognizing that we need to have compassion for people with addiction, and that people with addiction are valuable, and that we can change, all of that is really an important place to start. Once we can sort of let go of this idea that criminalization protects us, we can then really treat this as a health problem. I mean, one of the things that I always find weird when I argue with people who support criminalization is that they seem to think that, like, bringing coercion into the picture, like, is useful for health. And I usually make a flip remark at that point about the donut police. Are we really, like, do we think that, like, this would work for diabetes or, like, people who aren't complying with their, like, heart medication? Like, no, we realize that that's a health problem and that adding cops to the picture is not going to fix it. So I think the more we actually believe that addiction is a medical problem, the better off we will be. And bringing learning into the picture, to me, allows us to get past this, like, it's a disease, but the treatment is 12 steps. Because that paradox, like, confounds so many people. We've ended up in a situation where we have people strenuously arguing that it's a disease while proposing a treatment that is completely moral, and not realizing that this does not convince the public that it is not a criminal issue. So sort of thinking through these things and getting people to, like, really think about, okay, if you believe addiction is a disease, if you believe addiction is a learning disorder, and aka anything but a sin, what does that really mean? It really means that we can't lock people up for it. That doesn't mean you can't lock people up for doing things that hurt people.
Right.
But, you know, so I think some of, you know, just thinking through these ideas will help to, you know, move us forward. And I do think we're making some progress on using medication in treatment. I think we will continue to see that. I think we need to do some work on explaining, like, how that works and why it's not the case that people on medication are always high, and, you know, that dependence and addiction are not the same thing. But yeah, like, a lot of the work is around getting people to understand what addiction really is, and then going with the implications of that, basically.
That's great. Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Maya, again, for taking the time to talk with us and you know, just presenting this view. It's, I think, like I said in the beginning, all our listeners, psychologists, social workers, mental health workers, MFTs, should read this book. And especially if you're working in treatment, should absolutely read this book. So I just want to say thank you for taking the time and talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it. Well, that's our show. And like I said, you should absolutely pick up the book, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. A must read for all psychologists, MFTs, social workers, mental health workers, drug counselors, anybody working in treatment. You should read this book. So please pick it up. I will have a link, or there should be a link on this podcast below in the show notes. Just, you know, go grab it. It's worth the read. So that's it. So come find us. We love interfacing with people via social media. So we have a website, theradicaltherapist.com. We're on Twitter at The Rad Therapist, and we are on Instagram at The Radical Therapist. And yeah, just come seek us out, like us. And of course, don't forget about the YouTube channel. Go find the YouTube channel and subscribe, please, and share some of the videos with your friends or on your social media. We would really appreciate it. So as always, my name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist Podcast. Thanks for listening.